I'll begin with a definition of what OA is, including a discussion of what is the reach versus goal of open access. I'll talk about the role of OA publishing and federal, state, and institutional policies, and green open access and examples. And I'll conclude with some slides about where we're at now and where I see us going in the future with regard to open access. So I don't want to spend too much time on this, on definition, but an article is open access if it meets certain conditions. It's freely available, full text, to anyone with a web browser and internet access. It is also available immediately upon publication and permanently. These things constitute what is known as gratis open access, articles that are freely available online. The frequently cited definition of open access from the Budapest Initiative includes a condition that the article has unrestricted reuse rights associated with it. This is often referred to as Libre open access. The Creative Commons CC BY attribution license is the primary mechanism for authorizing others to reuse and build upon OA research. A frequently cited benefit of Libre OA is content mining and text mining that Robin mentioned earlier today. Content and text mining of tens of thousands of journal articles that are available Libre open access can be accomplished through computer analysis of natural language. And the more content that is available, the more effective that text mining can be to analyze and identify links between things like medicine and genes, or climate change and plant growth, or any other number of things. I'm stealing this slide from Peter Binfield. Oops. A co-founder of PeerJ, which is a biomedical science publisher. Because it very clearly demonstrates, at least for me, the benefits of OA in terms of potential reach. The tiny red box, and this is to scale, the tiny red box in the middle of the slide represents the number of people who have the potential to access an average article available in a toll journal, a subscription journal. When you publish with a toll journal, it's clear that you have very limited reach. The yellow box represents the potential audience of all the science and knowledge workers. Most of whom are not associated with institutions that are able to afford subscriptions to the huge number of toll journals that are out there. This potential audience does not have the ability to access articles available in those toll journals. And the big green box represents all the people in the world. Potential readers around the world who are unable to access articles published in toll journals. Except by begging, borrowing, and stealing. From my perspective, let me go back, as a librarian at a land-grant institution, I often describe OA in terms of citizen access to the research of our institution. Open access allows the fruits of research to be read and used by the people who pay for it. The taxpayer, as well as any decision makers, practitioners, and students, teachers, scientists, as well as faculty worldwide, not only those who are fortunate enough to be associated with research institutions, able to afford expensive journal subscriptions. And we know from Tim Jewell's talk earlier, there's no institution that can afford subscriptions to everything anymore, including the major research universities around the country. So aside from offering the broadest possible dissemination of research, open access demonstrably increases the impact of research. Countless studies show that articles available open access are cited more often than those available only through toll subscriptions. In 2010, Almost Swan looked at 31 articles that had been published up to that date, analyzing citation rates for articles available OA versus articles available in toll journals. and found that in nearly every study, the authors found a positive OA citation advantage. Two of the studies found no advantage, and only one, I believe, found a negative advantage in biology. There does appear to be a difference in the amount of advantage depending on the discipline. So the goal of open access is immediate access to articles available via an open access journal, regardless of the business model of that journal. As of yesterday, the directory of open access journals lists over 10,000 Gold OA journals. Three of the best known OA publishers, Public Library of Science, Biomed Central, and Hindawi, publish a substantial percentage of all Gold OA articles that are available. And Gold OA publishing is really dominated by those three major publishers. TOS was initiated by Harold Varmus, the Nobel Prize winner and former director of the NIH, Michael Eisen, a biologist from UC Berkeley, and Patrick Brown, a Stanford biochemist. TOS one of the seven journals published at TOS, is now the largest journal in the world, and responsible for publishing hundreds of articles every week. Biomed Central publishes I think around 500 open access peer-reviewed journals, and Hindawi out of Egypt publishes over 500 journals, and it's adding as many as 100 new journals each year. Hindawi began as a subscription publisher and moved entirely to an offer-paid model, a gold open access model, within 3 years, which perhaps demonstrates what other publishers may be forced to do eventually as we reach a tipping point of open access. So there are currently three primary funding models for Gold OA publishing. The publishing fees model, which we've heard about today, a model where there are no publishing fees, which I'll describe further, and a hybrid model. Under the publishing fees model, or the author processing charge model, which we've heard about, also known as author pays, authors are charged an article processing fee anywhere from $300 to $5,000 per article. PLOS One charges $1,350 per article, and some of its specialty journals charge up to $2,900. Biomed Central charges authors around $500, and Hindawi charges authors between $300 and $1,500. According to a comprehensive European Commission study that was conducted a couple of years ago, approximately 59% of article processing fees are paid by funding agencies. 24% of author fees are paid by universities on their author's behalf. And only 12% of the time are fees paid entirely by authors out of pocket. A recent Guardian article suggests that this may be a good reason to stop using the term author pays. An important emerging funding source for Gold OA that I expect to grow substantially in the coming years is Campus Open Access Funds. The way these funds work is that a pool of money is set aside by an institution specifically to reimburse article processing charges for articles published by faculty at open access journals. Libraries are increasingly covering a portion of these fees redirected from collection budgets. We've begun this in a limited way with membership to PLOS, PeerJ, and Biomed Central at Oregon State University, as UW apparently has as well. A second model, the one that's in fact at 2/3 of the journals listed in the directory of open access journals, does not charge off the processing fees at all. Instead, journal costs are sustained through financial or staffing support, usually associated with the university. University libraries are increasingly hosting and publishing open access journals that are affiliated with their faculty. I'm on the board of an open access journal, of the Journal of Librarianship and Scholarly Communication, which is hosted by Pacific University and falls under this model. Copy editing, layout, peer review administration, design, neither marketing for the journal, are all done voluntarily by faculty. Some societies are beginning to fund their journals using membership and or conference fees, rather than relying on libraries to fund the activities of the society through journal subscriptions. And that has, of course, been the model for most society publications for some time. So a growing number of toll journals are available or are adopting hybrid models. And under this model, the author can pay for an article available in a toll journal to be made available open access. The basic business model and source of funding for these journals remains library subscriptions. But author OA fees supplement that money. The term double dipping is used to describe this because publishers are receiving money through both the subscriptions already paid by university libraries, in addition to receiving money from the author's OA fee. Many libraries have a policy not to pay publication fees at hybrid journals for this reason. And hybrid journals usually charge author processing fees $1,500, but up to, I believe, $5,000. An emerging funding model for bold open access is the membership model adopted by PeerJ. Under this model, authors become members of PeerJ at different levels. Between a one-time fee of $99, which gives the author the right to publish one article a year, to $299, which entitles the author to publish as many articles as he or she wishes. Members must also agree to peer review or comment on a certain number of articles per year. This model is also being adopted increasingly by society publishers. And there are certainly other models that are appearing regularly. This is a growing, it's changing all the time. Even though publishing open access journals does cost money, it costs much less than publishing toll journals. OA journals do not have to maintain legacy operations such as printing. There are also savings from not maintaining or migrating off of legacy software. With OA, you don't have to pay a sales force to travel around the world, staff booths at conferences, and take you out to dinner, and that kind of thing. And you also dispense with significant legal fees. So you don't have to enforce copyright. Interesting developments in publishing, like open peer review, are largely happening with open access journals. It was interesting in Jevon's talk that he looked at PLOS. PLOS is, of course, an open access journal. Open access journals tend to be more interested in looking at how their articles are being used, and article metrics, for example. The focus clearly is on the article now, I think, not the journal or the issue. All metrics focuses on article use and citations in social media and blogs and other venues. It demonstrates the impact of articles on readers not necessarily associated with research institutions. Articles available open access are more likely to be discussed in social media venues like blogs and Twitter simply because more people are able to read the article and comment on it. The recent Science Magazine news story about open access, how many of you here have heard about this? I believe the title was Wild West of Open Access Publishing. Yeah. It was pitched to the press as an indictment of OA publishing. And that's how it's being picked up by a number of anti-OA commentators. I think this might classify as manufacturers. Is that right? For this article, the author sent a hoax article to OA journals that charge an author fee and found that a percentage of those journals published the article, apparently with little or no or very faulty peer review. It did expose the problem of predatory publishers, or predatory journals in the OA sphere, who charge author fees and publish articles without conducting proper peer review. But it's important to note that the study included no control of non-OA publishers, so it was only sent to OA publishers. We know, we've seen many examples today, that subscription journals are publishing, how should I put it?
Questionable.
There was an economist, of course, the Economist article a couple weeks ago that talked about the how peer review is being questioned and no longer working very well. That applies not just to OA journals, I think, maybe less. The Hopes article was published not only by predatory publishers with apparently no fixed address, but also by more established OA journals. PLOS and Hindawi did not publish the article, but a Sage and Elsevier OA journal did. Some, including one of the founders of PLOS, Michael Eisen, and the founder of PeerJ, Peter Benfield, has said that open peer review would solve the problem that the article brings to light on day one. Open peer review is conducted transparently, and the names of peer reviewers are given in most cases. Also, open peer review is based only on methodology, not on expected impact. So you wouldn't have the problem of the arsenic DNA article that appeared in Science Magazine a few years ago. So for journals that have open peer review, and there are only a few, and it is in the very early stages, that article would not have likely passed muster. That Hope So Way article. So far, I've described bold open access, the immediate availability of an article in an OA journal. Green open access is open access available through a repository, either an institutional repository like Scholar's Archive at OSU, ResearchWorks at UW, or a disciplinary repository like PubMed. Repositories hold peer-reviewed literature and often include other literature such as theses and dissertations, technical reports, university publications, data sets increasingly, and other materials. One huge advantage of green over old OA, at least in terms of funder and institutional policies and mandates, is that green can be mandated without violating academic freedom in any way. Gold OA mandates require that authors publish in a set of compliant journals, whereas green OA allows authors to publish in any journal, so long as they make a version of that article available in a repository. The Registry of Open Access Repositories lists more than 250 subject-based open access repositories and more than 2,300 institutional open access repositories. Nearly every open access repository at a university or funding agency has a green policy. That is, a policy requiring a deposit in an open access repository. 63% of total journals allow authors to deposit the final manuscript of articles. That's the peer-reviewed manuscript, or the peer-reviewed version, minus the final publisher formatting and copy editing, into an IR for a repository. If we buy into the idea that old OA, in whatever form, is the future, and told journals are on their way out, and I believe that, there are still clear advantages to green open access in the interim. One is that until that time, the gold OA is the publishing norm. The research published by told journals will continue to be restricted to the scientists associated with universities able to afford access to those journals, unless the articles are also deposited in OA repositories. And even after gold OA becomes predominant, and after subscription journals have shifted to gold OA, there's no guarantee that the journal back issues will be made available open access. Institutional open access policies are being passed that demonstrate a faculty's commitment to to the broadest possible dissemination and impact of the research conducted at their universities. The language and components of Oregon State University's policy, for example, is basically the same as the language and policies passed at MIT, Harvard, Georgia Tech, the UC system, Stanford, and many others. This increased standardization will benefit universities and faculty by signaling a unified stance about the open access that authors and institutions value. I'm just going to open or show you our policy and some of the terms in it, but I think I'll skip that to save some time. The rise of funder OA policies such as the NIH public access policy and other federal, state, and university open access policies are resulting in increasing numbers of articles being made available open access. I list some examples of public access policies here on this slide. We're at a point now where most publicly funded research in this country and the UK is required to be open access, even if implementation is lagging. And I noted on one of the slides over there that the very large percentage of scientific articles that are published are published by the United States and the UK. But there are, and as we heard earlier, there are articles being published around the world. Today, I learned that Argentina passed an open access mandate that requires any government-funded research coming out of that country to be made available open access. South America actually has a very strong open access history. They've always made their students' theses and dissertations available open access. We just began to do that in this country late 90s, and still most universities still are not doing that. Currently, there are over 80 funder open access mandates in place around the world. Again, a strong argument in their favor is that research that is taxpayer-funded, as all research that is funded by federal and state agencies is, should be made available to the taxpayers who funded it. Peter Seward, the longstanding OA advocate, now with Harvard, has said, today, policymakers agree that the question is not whether to make the shift to open access, but how. The White House Office of Science, Technology, and Policy Memorandum, issued in February 2013, was the result of information gathered by the White House as a result of the America Competes Reauthorization Act of 2010 that called upon OSTP to coordinate with agencies to develop policies that assure widespread public access of research resulting from federal grants. They received an overwhelming response in favor of the proposition that citizens deserve easy access to the results of scientific research their tax dollars paid for. The memorandum directs federal agencies with more than $100 million in annual research and development expenditures to work with stakeholders to make articles and research data also, associated with federally funded research freely available to the public. The policy is similar to the NIH public access policy passed in 2008, except that whereas the NIH policy makes clear the repository to which research should be made available, PubMed in that case, and also makes clear the embargoes that are to be associated with that research, 12 months in that case, the OST memorandum leaves open the question of implementation and is a little wishy-washy on the embargoes. There's no existing infrastructure like PubMed that can handle the huge number of articles and data that's generated from all U.S. federal agencies. And the directive is an unfunded mandate, so there's no money given to federal agencies to build such a platform or system. Two key stakeholders have stepped up with implementation proposals. A consortium of publishers has proposed CORUS, the clearinghouse for the open research of the United States, that would use publishers' existing infrastructure to identify and eventually provide free access to peer-reviewed articles based on publicly supported research. Meanwhile, the Association of Research Libraries has proposed SHARE, the Shared Access Research Ecosystem, which proposes a network of cross-institutional digital repositories based at research universities, as the digital home for the finished papers and the underlying data sets resulting from research produced with federal funds. These repositories already exist for the most part and can be made rather easily interoperable. It can also handle data. It's estimated that 25% of all peer-reviewed research articles published today are available in Access. The growth is a result of both Green and GoldOA. You can see, as far as growth of GoldOA, you can see from this graphic, which appeared in a Biomed Central Medicine article in 2012, the overall growth of GoldOA Access since 2000. You can also see that the author fees funding model is rising at a higher rate than the other models. The author fees model is shown there in light blue. The dark blue is those articles published in journals without an article processing charge, and the yellow is higher, those published in higher journals. David Lewis, in a well-known article that appeared in College and Research Libraries this year, using a method defined by business theorist Clayton Christensen, predicts that GoldOA could account for 50% of published journal articles sometime between 2017 and 2021, and 90% of articles as soon as 2020, and more conservatively by 2025. My experience working with faculty who passed an OA policy at Oregon State is that most researchers really don't think much about why their articles are behind a paywall and have no idea how much those journals charge libraries for subscriptions. It does not feel wrong or odd for faculty to put their papers behind a subscription wall that's controlled by a publisher because most articles are behind a subscription barrier and have been, always have been. But if a large fraction of papers are published on an open access basis, the situation may flip, at which time researchers may object to having their papers behind a subscription barrier that limits their dissemination and their impact. This could well result in a default expectation from authors in the future that their articles will be open access. I think the funder and institutional mandates and policies are bringing to light publisher-public pricing practices and beginning to establish an understanding and appreciation of open access among faculty, even though there remains a lot of misunderstanding about open access. As I already noted, many subscription publishers offer hybrid open access, and some see hybrid as a transitory step towards all of it paid by publishing fees. Major subscription publishers like Elsevier, Springer, are experimenting with all GoldOA journals. We're also witnessing the rapid growth of GreenOA with the development of federal mandates and institutional policies. With these requirements in place, deposit of articles to repositories will increasingly become the norm and recognized by authors as a natural step of the publishing process. When an increasing percentage of articles becomes available to read, it makes sense that universities will begin to cancel subscriptions, rely on the free availability of scholarship, and use collection funds formerly dedicated to paying subscriptions to funding article publishing fees in OA journals. I estimate that this will begin to happen in the next 5 years if the funder policies are actively implemented. And I think subscription journals will increasingly shift to all OA, or perhaps go under, although that could take quite a bit of time. That's all I have.
Server. So is it possible for them to actually continue scaling to maybe 2,000 articles a week if they wanted to get the appropriate peer review?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it is possible. And we've seen that growth over time. PLOS was initiated in 2005, 2004, whenever that was. It was a smaller, regularly sized publisher, and it just continued to increase the number of articles they published. And I think it's likely, and I think there's some concern about that as well, as we see some more monopolization of the journal market.
So I have a general question about open access and how that refers back to things that are essentially already published. So when I talk to OA advocates, even if everything tomorrow now was going to be published OA, there's over 10 million articles that are still locked up behind the paywall. So I ask people, what's your plan for getting those things released? And I just never seem to get an answer to that. So do you have any ideas that, as even if we migrate at the rate we're talking about, we're in 2020, most of the things are being published that way, how do we get access to that huge database of information that currently is locked up?
It's a huge problem, and I mentioned that as a huge advantage of green open access. Authors can deposit their articles in institutional repositories today, and if Goal OA does eventually take precedence, those articles will still be available. As far as getting journals as journals go out of business or as they transition to all OA, I have no idea. It's possible they might see that as a I'm not sure.
You're doing it with books.
It's certainly possible to digitize all that material quite easily, or it's already available.
So I work with faculty, I go through their CVs, and I actually get access to the art and published work. I either put up the poster preprint while still citing the journal, the final published one, as well as I've gotten access to book chapters by contacting publishers. So that there is a possibility of going back, and that's what I do like every day, is go through my faculty CV and churn up their content. So your repository here, are you at UW?
No.
Okay, so that a lot of university libraries have repositories, and that's what they do.
And if you're not at a university?
I'm sorry?
And if you're not at a university?
You can stick it up on Archive. It's a bunch of repositories that are subject-based. Archive is predominantly preprints, and that's what a lot of the researchers are just slapping their stuff out there before it's.
Well, that actually raises another question. So, as I understand it, for people who are publishing in the total journals and are allowed, and I think maybe even are required, to go ahead and take the preprint version and post that somewhere, that the rate of people doing that is really not so high. Do you have a number, and how can that be written?
Yeah, that is an issue. PubMed, with the NIH policy there, I think they, once they mandate it, so the initial NIH policy only suggested, I'm not sure what proceedings, but suggested that authors deposit their post-print data in PubMed. And they got less than 5% authors doing that. After they mandated it, and it became clear that future funding could depend on their depositing the results of their research. The number is now well above 80%. I don't remember what the number is, 85%. As far as institutional mandates or institutional policies, we are right now seeing about 50% of the articles that are published by OSU faculty getting deposited in as well as our work. We hope that will improve as faculty become more aware of it, but it's not ideal, but it's getting us going.